From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At Reed College, the senior thesis is an essential part of a college experience. They call it an intellectual adventure and perhaps the most challenging thing students have ever done. At Reed and around the country, college theses are in, from the science lab to the heart of a fairy tale adaptation. To coffee farms in Nicaragua, submitted and bound by undergraduate seniors eager to share their findings, their research, their journey. An opportunity to get to the heart of an issue and really dig deep. We have six brave souls with us today, this hour On Point, exploring the world of the college thesis. You can join us on air or online. College seniors, are you still burning the midnight oil to meet the deadline? Long ago writers, can you even remember the title of your thesis? You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, as commencement season begins, actor Martin Sheen addresses the class of 2015 at the University of Dayton. We'll hear some of that. But first, digging into senior theses. Joining me from Washington, Tim Grieve, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. He graduated from Stanford. He did not write a thesis, but we can all agree he's a smart guy. Tim, welcome. So great to have you.
Hey, Jane. Thanks very much.
You and I have... We've come a long way since our high school days together in Northern California, might I say.
Exactly. Did you write a thesis?
No, I didn't either. So we're in good company, you and I.
We're very, very well prepared for this conversation.
From Portland, Oregon, Chris Gralty did. He's with us. He's a 22-year-old senior at Reed College studying biology and psychology. His thesis is titled Neuronal Dynamics of Graphene-Colored Synesthesia. Chris, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So I just read the title of your thesis. Now translate for us.
Yeah. So for my thesis, I investigated synesthesia, which is a neurological phenomenon in which people experience a crossing of the senses. So, for example, there's a famous person with synesthesia who tastes sound. The tones of people's voices elicit tastes in her mouth, and it's actually really interesting sometimes. If someone's voice is particularly unpleasant, it can make her throw up.
Oh, my.
Because the taste is so awful in her mouth.
So you taste sound. You also see letters as colors. Is that right?
Yeah. So in my case, I recorded, for my thesis, I recorded the brain activity of 10 current students at Reed who see color when they are reading letters or numbers.
Mm. So you spent a lot of time in the lab, a lot of hands-on work for this. Tell us what you found.
So basically what I was looking at is the timing of brain activity related to synesthetic perception. So what I found was that individuals who see color when they look at letters, the brain activity, they show very fast and active brain activity that looks like color perception when they're looking at achromatic letters or numbers. Basically, brain areas that are involved in letter perception and color perception are being activated simultaneously and very quickly.
And so how would someone with this, with synesthesia, use it to their advantage, did you find in your thesis study?
Yeah, so it seems the research shows that synesthesia is actually highly correlated with high IQ, higher creativity, and improved memory. It seems like having color associations with letters and numbers actually helps you remember a lot of things better. It makes sense if you think about it. If you learn a new word as a 7-year-old and you're trying to remember how it's spelled, it helps if you can also think about what colors it looks like to you.
And so how'd you get interested in this topic? Why did you choose it? Do you have this?
No, so I don't have synesthesia, but I became really interested in it when I heard about it in intro psychology class at Reed. And actually went out to dinner with some friends that night after I'd heard about it and talked about it with them. And one of my friends was like, oh, well, doesn't everybody think that letters have colors? I mean, did you not all feel that way? And we were really surprised. And it turned out she had synesthesia and didn't know it. So I've been interested in it for a very long time, and I was really happy to be able to do it for my thesis.
Does everyone have it in the same way? Does everyone who have the sound taste thing, they all think that Bruce Springsteen tastes like hot dogs, or is there different?
It seems to be really inconsistent between people. So even within families, it seems like people who are synesthetes who have kids are more likely to be synesthetic as well. Even within families, it doesn't seem to be similar. So a parent could feel that the letter A is red, but their son might feel that it's really, really blue.
Wow.
And why do you have this? Why does a person have this?
Yeah, so it seems like there is increased connectivity between brain areas related to letter processing and color processing, and that could be. The genetic research is still kind of looking into this phenomenon and trying to understand where it's coming from. It doesn't seem to be a very simple, you know, there's this one gene that's different in synesthetes. But there do seem to be some regions of chromosomes that are related to it. So I would say in this case, it's kind of a both nature and nurture type of thing where when we're learning letters and numbers as kids, and we're also learning colors, if our brains are more likely to make those connections, then that can happen.
That's so interesting. So, Chris, this was your senior thesis. Do you want to continue this research after you're finished with college? Do you want to go on to this area of study?
Absolutely, yeah. I think synesthesia is really interesting. Sensory systems have always been really interesting to me. I'm definitely interested in continuing my neuroscience research, yeah.
Is it true that everyone at Reed, after they finish this tradition of the senior thesis, has one big bonfire for one particular purpose?
This past weekend we had our Ren Fair, which is when we celebrate turning in our theses. It starts with a thesis parade where we burn drafts of our theses, and it's great. All of our professors come and spray us with champagne, and it's a really good time. Yeah.
A rite of passage. Chris Gralty, thank you so much. It's very interesting.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Chris Gralty is a senior at Reed College studying biology and psychology. Here's another student joining us from Sarasota, Florida, Cassandra Corrado, 22-year-old senior at the New College of Florida studying literature and gender studies. Her thesis is titled Rewriting Women's Stories, Modern Adaptations of Fairy Tales and Their Feminist Implications. Cassandra, so nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
So take us into your world, into your senior thesis world, and into the world of fairy tales. What did you find?
You know, this actually wasn't my first project, and my first project was looking at different adaptations of The Arabian Nights. And I don't know if you've ever read The Arabian Nights, but they're about 1,000 pages long. So I decided to go in this other direction that was still tied towards oral tales. And so what we know about fairy tales is that they're rooted in oral storytelling. You know, you hear them in your living room. Usually your mother or your grandmother will read them aloud. And historically, that's been true for centuries. And so what I was really interested in looking at was how that could shift over time and how different cultural standards, cultural norms, we call them, could affect how people tell these stories and could affect how the people in the stories are portrayed. And so what I found was that starting in the 1970s, feminist authors, or authors with a feminist agenda possibly, were rewriting a lot of fairy tales, particularly Snow White, Cinderella, and Sleeping Beauty, and trying to change their heroines and change the destinies and in some ways make their lives worse in a really interesting sense, but in a lot of ways to make their lives better. And basically what I was looking at was why, like what was triggering that.
And what did you find?
And so what I found was that in the 1970s and 1980s, feminists were really concerned about the position of women in society. And so are women allowed to divorce? Are they expected to become mothers? Are they allowed to work? Are they expected to be these silent, passive creatures? You know, we think of Snow White, and we see her whiteness. We see that in her story, in the Grimm's Brothers story, she doesn't speak at all. And so you have this really passive character who has all of these things done to her, and ultimately she comes out sort of on top. But for feminist authors, this was really alarming because you had a protagonist who that basically was like, you are 10 years old. This is your past. You are going to be silent. You're going to experience these trials, and what you're going to respond with is taking care of a house properly, is going to be making sure that you are responding to the men in your life appropriately and taking care of their needs. And then ultimately that you're going to marry and then have children. And so that's what the Snow White narrative tells us. And feminists in the 70s and 80s said, absolutely not. This is not what you need to be telling a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, women of any age, about what their life path should be.
Tim Grieve, do you think about Snow White and The Little Mermaid a little differently now that we've heard from Cassandra Corrado?
I do. I have a teenage daughter, and we spent last night talking about whether she should study Arabic in high school and so she could be an anti-terrorist agent. So this is a very different perspective than I think my family has come through. What how has this changed since the 70s and 80s, do you think? I think a lot of the talking of sort of fairy tales with kids now are not so much recounting the Cinderella story, but talking about the Disney princesses or what have you. Has that changed things?
It absolutely has. And I actually, in my thesis, particularly when I was discussing The Little Mermaid, talked a lot about what I refer to as the Disney princess machine. In a lot of ways, Disney, starting with Snow White in, I believe, 1939, in the late 1930s, started basically knocking out these princess stories one after one. They found that they were huge money makers. And then in the 70s, that started to fail. And so you don't actually see anything come back until The Little Mermaid in 1989. And so what you see then is, instead of people knowing about the original versions of these fairy tales, instead of knowing the Grimm's Brothers stories, which we know are a lot more horrific than Disney's adaptations, or knowing Andersen's version of The Little Mermaid, people think The Little Mermaid, and they think a long red-haired mermaid with a purple seashell bra. And so they, you have that image in your mind when you think of fairy tales, even though they might not actually be true to their original stories. And in a lot of ways, it makes fairy tales more accessible, but at the same time, Disney has a very specific agenda. They're seeking to have these tales be directed towards children, and because of that, they sanitize them in a lot of ways. So they take out the issues of sexual violence. They take out the issues of class struggle. They might take out the issues of racialization, or in Disney's case, they might amplify them a lot of the time. And so the Disney version really shifts things.
Cassandra, real quick, do you have a favorite female heroine? And did it change after you did your senior thesis?
You know, I think I would still have to say that The Little Mermaid is my favorite. She really gets to carve her own destiny, and I think that's really important for young girls to see.
Cassandra Corrado, senior at the New College of Florida, thank you so much for explaining your senior thesis to us. Good luck.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with college seniors this hour about their theses, the journey they set out on in their final year of college. Tim Grieve is with us this hour as a ride along on this terrific journey, editor-in-chief at the National Journal. A lot of listeners are responding here. Lisa says her senior thesis was Jewish Women Immigrants, Assimilation and American Public Schools. She says she loved every minute of it, went on to become a historian and teach thesis writing courses to 20 years of undergrads. Gina says, my English literature thesis was titled The Age's Broken Heart, An Evil Creature as a Moral Being in Interview with the Vampire. Tim, that's a good one.
Wow. I think mine was the relative merits of Mickey's Big Mouth and Heineken. So this is we've come a long way in the U.S. educational system.
Let's go to another one here in Waltham, Massachusetts. Charlie Madsen, he's a 22-year-old senior at Brandeis University studying musical theater, writing, and psychology. His thesis titled Grace is an original musical with 14 songs. Charlie, so nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us what you did here.
So I started my career as a musical composer actually when I was six, writing songs for my recitals. And I never really thought I could write a play, but then I took a class my sophomore year of college called Writing for Musical Theater with my advisor, Neil Hampton, and it really opened my eyes to being able to write in a more interdisciplinary nature. And so I took playwriting classes, directing classes, and then I culminated that talent through doing my thesis, which is a book musical.
So let's listen to part of it here. This is the original musical score. You've got 14 songs within the musical. Here it is, recorded last month at Brandeis Senior Festival. So what was the process like for you, Charlie?
The process was a little crazy because With another like typical academic thesis, how you can like go into the stacks, write for hours at night, I couldn't really rely on myself. It was such a collaborative process that the play had to be ready in order for me to rehearse it. And I couldn't really change the music, otherwise I'd have to teach new music. And it was very much reliant on other people. And so I had to be very disciplined in getting everything ready on time and making it presentable.
Do you think you have a future in musical theater?
I hope I have a future in musical theater. I always tell people I'd like to be in the next Sondheim, which is a very lofty goal. But I really love writing for musical theater, and I hope I can do it for the rest of my life.
Well, I hope we gave you a boost today. Good luck to you, Charlie Madison. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
Charlie Madison is a senior at Brandeis University studying musical theater, writing, and psychology. His thesis was titled Grace, an original musical with 14 songs about high school kids. Actually, hear voices. Let's get some listeners in here. Nikita is in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Nikita. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. So I'm here in Detroit, Michigan, and as you know, there's a lot of things going on in Detroit, a lot of up-and-coming things. So I wanted to focus on Wayne State University and the relationship that Wayne State University has with Detroit. So specifically, my thesis focused on what can Wayne State University do to ensure that the poor in Detroit have a voice.
Mm, terrific. And how was the process for you, Nikita? What did you learn personally?
It was a fantastic process. This was a creative essay, so I was able to draw on a lot of my own experiences for the past 4 years as a student here. You know, I've done a lot of volunteering within the community. I've been really active in Detroit politics, so, you know, a lot of what I wrote about came from my own personal experiences, and that's what made my thesis so special.
Mm. Nikita, thanks so much for calling. Let's get another senior in here joining us from Newark, Delaware. Carrie Snyder, senior at the University of Delaware, studying wildlife conservation, agriculture, and natural resources. Her thesis is titled Which Trees Best Support Neotropical Migrant Birds on Shade-Grown Coffee Farms. Carrie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So why in the world did you choose this?
So I grew up on a farm in western Massachusetts and also did significant work with gardening and things like that in Pennsylvania. And so I've always had a passion for agriculture. It's been a part of my background. And I came to UD and I studied wildlife conservation. So I started getting really interested in how agriculture and conservation can kind of go together, because we think of large agriculture nowadays as kind of destroying the landscape in many ways. And I was really interested to see how conservation and agriculture can mix and really join together.
So I'll ask this sensitively. Are there practical applications for your senior thesis, Carrie?
Definitely. I was down in Nicaragua actually observing birds on a coffee farm to see which trees that they seem to forage in the most, and comparing that to insect diversity being supported on those same trees. And the idea, the end goal for this is to improve coffee certification programs so that instead of just advising farmers to have shade-grown coffee or to support birds in that way and create habitat, we can actually say which trees might be the best for that. So it definitely has implications.
Mm.
And how exactly did you sell that to your parents? I'm going to go to Nicaragua and watch birds on trees.
Well, my parents are very supportive. They've done a lot of traveling themselves. Definitely, they got a little nervous, but they actually came down with me for some time as well, so they got to experience it with me.
Here's some sound of the warbler bird, a subtropical migratory bird. I guess you heard some of these, Carrie?
Yeah, so my focal species were yellow warbler and Tennessee warbler, which are both neotropical migrants. They come from North America and then in the winter go to South America. So other species that we are concerned about are things like the cerulean warbler and golden-winged warbler, which are of conservation concern, and they're actually suffering from habitat loss. And a lot of shade-grown coffee farms are converted to sun-grown, that is, the trees are cut down so that the farmers can get higher yield. And so that is a real big source of habitat loss for them.
What was the process of writing this, Carrie, and how long was the thesis?
The thesis is about You're talking page length?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
It's about 40 pages. The process basically, so I was doing a really quantitative study. And so I went down and took data on just how many minutes birds were in the tree species I used. And then trying to see, did a test to see if they were foraging randomly. That is, they were choosing each tree equally. It didn't matter what species. Hmm. And I found that it wasn't equal. So the birds are choosing certain species.
Hmm.
And
so is there one best tree that you've decided?
I have preliminary results, but it's definitely going to have to be repeated. What I'm looking at is there's been research done in the United States in temperate regions showing that native trees actually are better at supporting insect communities than exotics. But there's also variation among native trees. So you'll have an oak tree supporting over 500 species of Lepidoptera of caterpillars, and something like a tulip tree supporting only 21.
Hmm.
So I'm expanding that research into this coffee work.
Carrie, hold on. Let's get a call in here. Don in Brecksville, Ohio. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I'm a professor of communication at the College of Worcester in Ohio. And I just wanted to share with your audience that we, for decades, have done something called our independent study, or IS. It's a requirement of every student, every senior at the college. It involves two semesters of mentored research. And as a faculty member, you just see incredible abilities in all students, from our brightest to others, including kids with learning differences. And they take on a process involving developing a research question and studying literature review. And the writing ultimately culminates in a document or a performance, oftentimes a oral. It does require an oral defense or a poster. And I just wanted to say that this is also incredibly rewarding to faculty members. Not only do we see the growth of the students, but really the independence that they bring to the research effort. And the ultimate outcome is many students going on to graduate schools and just becoming a very different learner, knowing that everyone is involved in this process.
So, Tim Grieve, any questions for our illustrative professor here?
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I would think a lot of faculty members would find this maybe the worst part of their job. You say that they actually find it rewarding.
I think at times it is challenging. I jokingly have said it sucks the marrows out of my bones. But in the end, when you see a student who starts with a kind of a primitive question that they bring to the stage, not from us, you just see and get involved and enthusiastic. And we are given credit. The college is good about that. But in the end, it really is the most rewarding thing, seeing a student at the end know more than their faculty member about a particular topic. We've just coached and mentored and supported them. And the College of Worcester is very proud of this process. It also involves funding for many of these students to even develop some of their projects, including studying abroad.
Professor, have you ever turned down a thesis request? Some of these are really out there, I got to say.
They can be out there, but we kind of shape it. I have never tried to change a student in another direction from what they came to the table. It's an independent study, their idea versus ours. But certainly there are students who don't always do the best job. But we have honors and goods and satisfactories. And I'm pleased to say all of the students that I've worked with received one of those grades. And I probably was more proud of an honors in a student who really was a learning challenged person. Can you imagine writing a thesis? I know I didn't and probably couldn't. And it's quite rewarding and something the College of Worcester is most proud of.
Don, thank you so much from Brecksville, Ohio. I will take this moment to add that our director on Point here also went to the College of Worcester. Purely coincidentally here with the call we just received, Eileen Amata in Ohio, her senior thesis was about cyanobacteria, a.k.a. pond scum. Is that right, Eileen? Did I get that right, pond scum? Yes. Science and journalism combined. All right, Heather in Augusta, Georgia, your turn. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I actually just completed my version of a thesis, which was a solo exhibition. I'm receiving my BFA in art from Georgia Regents University, and I'm actually about to break it down today, but it was an installation, and I made 7 hardback books I wrote all the text and it was screen printed, but it was displayed on tables accompanied by stools. So the viewer was able to sit down on the stool while reading the book. And the every inch of the walls were covered in cheesecloth, which I dyed by hand, 300 yards. And there was also a projection involved.
Wow.
So, and I also did a an artist talk to accompany that.
Tim Grieve, I haven't heard one that beats that yet, actually.
I really haven't. What was the message you wanted people to walk away with?
Well, there were several things. The idea of a safe space, which you hear constantly in the media and just our society, is that's one of the focuses we have right now, is the idea of a safe space, but taken to the extreme of almost a censorship of any discussion that can be seen as offensive. So my books, I actually talked about the value of vulgarity. So to be in a protected space, but to still engage in confrontational ideas with other people. And all of the text that I wrote was in the second person. So the viewer, by saying you to the viewer or reader, they almost become the protagonist in the book. Mm.
Heather, thank you so much. I'm glad you called in. Boy, what a labor of love that is. A lot of listeners in here. Stephanie says, my senior thesis was Writing the Body, and it was an analysis of three novels vis-a-vis French feminism. Susan Rutterman says hers was titled The Narrative Tradition of the Nero Legend, intended to fulfill the requirements of a joint concentration in classics and folklore and mythology. What I learned, she says, it's been 30 years. I've forgotten. Alan is in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm kind of from a different angle here.
Okay.
I listen to these people, and I see there's so much value in writing a thesis, and I'm almost jealous of them. My school, University of Florida, did not require one to write a thesis, and I feel a bit cheated. So I think for parents or people looking for, you know, potential universities to go to, may want to check that out to be sure that that's part of the curriculum, to give them that value that all these callers are talking about that I felt a little bit cheated out of.
Left out of. Alan, thank you. Tim Grieve, did you feel cheated? They're a graduate of Stanford University, went on to great things, but you did not write a senior thesis.
I think maybe 25 or 30 years, or I don't even want to count how many years later, I may feel cheated. I certainly do not feel cheated in the moment.
Carrie Snyder, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So you wrote this thesis, Which Trees Best Support Neotropical Migrant Birds on Shade-Grown Coffee Farms. So now, what now, Carrie? You're graduating, going on to do what?
I am actually have accepted an invitation to serve in the Peace Corps. So I'll be going to Paraguay in September, and I'm going to be training to be a protected areas management promoter in Paraguay.
Awesome. And what did your friends think about this process? Was this fun for you all to do? Was this enjoyable in any way, or was it just
the thesis?
Yeah.
It was. So it's definitely a labor of love, and there are, you know, ups and downs. But I think in the end, my peers are proud of what they have accomplished, and just it really gives meaning to the college experience.
Carrie Snyder, a senior at the University of Delaware, thank you so much for being here today, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. Tom here. The On Point podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Here at the show, we interview many book authors, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, bestsellers or lesser-known but equally important titles. We love making you aware. Now, Audible.com is helping make books even more accessible, allowing you to listen to great titles whenever and wherever you want. They offer 180,000 titles, and right now, On Point listeners can get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. You can get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the ideas and research emerging from college theses across the country this year. Tim Grieve, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, is with us. Let's bring in from Washington, Isaac Flagel-Mishlove. He's a 22-year-old senior at Georgetown University studying Latin American and Middle Eastern studies. His thesis is titled On the Edge of Diaspora, Dynamics Between Established and Emergent Jewish Communities of Ecuador. Isaac, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. It's great to be here.
So tell us about why you wrote this.
Well, the story began when I was studying abroad, living in Quito, Ecuador, and I wanted to involve myself with the Jewish community there. So one of my first weeks, I took the long bus ride up to the northern suburbs of the city where the Jewish community is. I had found out about it online and emailed, and it was really one of the most powerful experiences of my life, sitting down at the synagogue, as I say in my thesis, on the edge of diaspora, singing the same melodies that we do in the United States or that I've heard in Israel. And I wanted to get to know a lot more about this community, and it was an exciting process.
And so what is the difference between the two, between the established Jewish community and the emergent Jewish community in Ecuador?
Yeah, so the established Jewish community is a group of Jews of European descent who came during and after World War II. All of them are refugees from the war or even Holocaust survivors. The emergent communities have a much more complicated and interesting tale, but essentially they're native Ecuadorians born and raised Catholic who, for some reason or another, which I discuss in my thesis, go through these spiritual journeys and become Jews. They convert to Judaism, they form Jewish communities.
And so beyond that, what were the conclusions you came to because of your research?
Well, I was familiar from my time living in Ecuador before I went back for my field research that there's significant tension between the communities. The emergent communities feel seriously and unfairly rejected from the established communities in the instances that they've tried to integrate. And I went down and discovered what I call 6+1 factors that determine that relationship. I won't go through all of them, but the biggest ones are in the established community a sense of exclusive community unity. They say, we're European, we've gone through this, these traumas of the Holocaust, World War II, we've built this community from the ground up, and we're all mostly just family. So we're not just a Jewish community, but we're a specific group. This isn't just a place for anyone with a Jewish identity to come join. That's the largest factor. Then there are also some serious issues with classism. The established community is incredibly affluent. They're good and kind people, and I have a great deal of affection for them, but there's undoubtedly some tension that comes from the disparity between their wealth and the emergent community's working class or even impoverished status.
Tim Grieve, quite an unusual and interesting topic, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, how did the process change you?
Well, when I was in Ecuador doing the research, particularly with the emergent communities, I was very challenged in that I felt my own prejudices, my own racism and classism coming out, things that I didn't think I had in me, but having grown up in a European or an Ashkenazi white American Jewish community, being in these emergent community was quite uncomfortable sometimes, and I myself found myself saying, who are they? What are they doing? Why do they want to be a part of worldwide Jewish communities? But in the end, especially after coming home, writing and thinking, you know, I've found a great deal of sympathy or at least understanding for these communities and respect very much the processes they're going through and this kind of spiritual journey that they're exploring.
Isaac Flagel-Mishlove, senior at Georgetown University studying Latin American studies and Middle Eastern studies. We wish you all the best, Isaac. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to New York. Allie Engelberg, a 22-year-old senior at Barnard College, majoring in American Studies and Film Studies. Her thesis is titled, How to Adjust the Depiction of Grief and Mourning in Post-9/11 Television and Film. Allie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So your thesis takes a deep look at how our culture deals with grief and mourning. Explain why you wrote about this.
It's actually an interesting journey. I really wanted to write about cowboys for my thesis, which is an academic passion of mine and has been throughout my 4 years of college. But I kept bringing my advisor scenes and selections that I thought were interesting, and he pointed out to me that they all contained funerals. And he said to me in a meeting, "Man, Allie, it really seems like you want to write about grief and mourning." And that took me sort of in quite a shock, because what he did not know is that I had lost my mother 2 years ago to cancer after a 7-year battle with cancer, and he had no idea of this personal story of mine. But through my sort of subconscious academic need, I ended up writing about my own personal experience through my expertise. I'm also a double major in film, so through my expertise in film and TV. So that was quite an interesting personal journey for me that led to sort of the academic culmination of my college years.
And so what did you find, specifically as it relates to late-night comedians and late-night talk shows?
Sure. So I did my analysis through the lens of Judith Butler's 2003 book, Precarious Lives, where she sort of critiques the a number of practices that Americans went through between the years of 2001 and 2003 when she wrote the book. And in that chapter on late-night comedy in New York, I looked at Conan O'Brien and Letterman and Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show. Each of those four programs had immediate sort of host talking to the camera responses to the attacks as they returned to air. And Butler says that our explanation of experiences in the I, using I statements, so I feel this, I feel that, she says that that precludes our ability to understand the greater context of the world at that time and how these attacks were sort of how they occurred and how they got there. By starting with the I, we lose a sense of worldliness. So I looked at those programs through that lens and critiquing the way that they spent so long on their own sort of stories instead of using their platform to inform their audiences, you know, in this case, the younger demographic who, as we all like to say, get their news from The Daily Show, what was going on.
Speaking of The Daily Show, here's a clip from Jon Stewart, host of the Comedy Central show, on September 20th, 2001, after September 11th, starts the show by speaking about coping with tragedy and getting back to normal life.
We've had an unenduring pain here, and unendurable pain. And I wanted to tell you why I grieve. But why I don't despair.
What did you personally learn from this process, Allie?
As some of people have said on the program so far, my thesis was required of my major, but I'm so glad that it was. And I sort of came away from this project learning that your personal identity and your academic identity, your intellectual life, are so inextricable from each other that when I attempted to write something that I thought was scholarly and, worthy of study, quote-unquote, I sort of led myself back to my own life story and to the pursuits of something that would make me have more clarity in my own life.
Well, Allie Engelberg, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Senior at Barnard College, majoring in American Studies and Film Studies. Her thesis is titled, How to Adjust the Depiction of Grief and Mourning in Post-9/11 Television and Film. Let's get a call in here. Will in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Will. Glad you waited. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Yeah, so my undergraduate institution, Wabash College, had a little bit of a different take on the thesis. We actually are one of the last schools that has senior oral comprehensive exams. Mm. And so in the second half or in the second semester of your senior year, you actually had to sit in front of a panel of faculty members, one from your major, one from your minor, and an at-large faculty member who could have been from any number of disciplines, and actually had to answer questions and have a conversation with them about anything they wanted to for an hour. And that you had to pass that in order to graduate. Mm.
If you didn't pass, you didn't graduate. Oh, my.
That's exactly right.
Thanks for a whole dose of new nightmare material. That's really great.
Right. Well, thanks for calling from New Orleans. I appreciate it. You know, we have about a minute left here, Tim Grieve. I'm going to wrap up by telling you we had a lot of fun with this as a staff. And I'm going to read to you, Tim Grieve, some of the theses that came from our own On Point team. Okay?
Wow.
Here's Karen Schiffman, our executive producer, Barnard College. Her senior thesis was The Three Melville Revivals, A Study of a Literary Reputation. That sounds like Karen. Nick Anderson, our digital producer, the University of North Carolina. His senior thesis, Too Funny to Be Real, Social Protests and Cultural Memory Through Four Post-World War II American Operas, 1934 to 1954. And our intern, Caitlin O'Keefe from Bowdoin College, her senior thesis, Emerson's Imprisoned Spirits, Freedom, Slavery, Liberalism.
I feel unworthy.
Tim Grieve, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, Stanford grad, former managing editor of Politico. Let's not wait another 20 years to talk again, okay?
Perfect. Look forward to it.
Thank you so much for being here today, Tim. In a moment, actor Martin Sheen's message of humanitarianism for the class of 2015. This is On Point. Well, it's commencement season, and in the coming weeks, we'll be airing excerpts from notable speakers at colleges and universities across the country. Last Sunday, Ramon Estevez, better known as actor Martin Sheen, received an honorary degree from the University of Dayton for his lifelong commitment to peace, social justice, and human rights. It was his father's dream for him to go to the university. But Sheen intentionally failed the school's entrance exam and went to New York to pursue an acting career instead. He joked about still being recognized for his iconic role as President Josiah Bartlett in West Wing. But he told the graduates, acting is what he does for a living. Activism is what he does to stay alive.
Whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, we are all responsible for each other and the world, which is exactly the way it is, because consciously or unconsciously, we have made it so. And while none of us made any of the rules that govern the universe, we do make all the rules that govern our own hearts and minds. And we are all beneficiaries of those endless number of strangers who have lived on this globe from every nation of the world for time immemorial. And they assure us that the world is still a wonderful and safe place despite our fear. And we're not asked to do great things. We're asked to do all things with greater care. Now, such an ideal is rare in a culture of so many compromised values and so much cynicism, a culture that all too often knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And yet there remains a very real and mysterious yearning deep within each and every human heart that compels us to reach outside of ourselves and help others for our own sake. Now, this yearning is a manifestation, I believe, of our true selves and leads us to the very first small conscious acts of personal heroism, which often brings rejection from the crowd, but satisfaction from the heart. This yearning, however, can be very, very costly. If it were not so, we would be left to question its value. But remember this above all. One heart with courage is a majority. Over the entire history of the human race, no one has ever made any real contribution without personal suffering, self-sacrifice, and sometimes even death. The Irish tell the story of a man who arrives at the gates of heaven and asks to be let in. St. Peter says, of course, just show us your scars. The man says, I have no scars. St. Peter says, what a pity. Was there nothing worth fighting for? My fondest wish for each and every one of us is that we will find something in our lives worth fighting for. Because when we do, we will have found a way to unite the will of the Spirit with the work of the flesh, and the world would discover fire for the second time. Then may the light and the heat from that fire confirm our purpose with every thought, every word, every action, to help heal a broken world wherever we may find it, and so that in the end we may be made worthy of the long-promised blessing reserved for the peacemakers and those that do justice. And we can lift up people everywhere to that place where the heart is without fear and the head is held high, where knowledge is free, where the world has not been broken up into fragments by narrow domestic walls, where words come out from the depths of truth and tireless striving stretches its arms towards perfection, where the clear stream of reason has not lost its way into the dreary desert sands of dead habit, where the mind is led forward by thee into ever widening thought and action, into that heaven of freedom, dear Father, let us all awake. Thank you so much.
Actor Martin Sheen addressing graduates at the University of Dayton on Sunday. For a video of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Many thanks to my guests this hour. A lot of fun. Thank you, listeners, as well, for wonderful, insightful comments. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.